At this point in the book of Deuteronomy, now that we've been reading chapter after chapter of these ancient laws, you might be asking yourself whether and why, as Christians, we still need all of this. What's the point of reading all these rules and commands about kings and armies and how to treat cattle and when to celebrate long-forgotten festivals? After all, didn't Jesus summarize all the Old Testament laws by telling us just to love God and love our neighbor? Isn't that what's really important? I don't know if you've wondered that as we've been making our way through Deuteronomy, but if you have, then you're not alone. Plenty of modern Christians don't see much need for all these old Mosaic laws and think that all we really need to know is that we should love God with our whole hearts and love our neighbors as ourselves. But there are two problems with that assumption. First, when Jesus gives those two commands, he's not making up a new law. He's just quoting the law of Moses. The law about loving God comes directly from Deuteronomy 6, as we've already discussed. And the command to love your neighbor as yourself is a direct quotation of Leviticus 19, verse 18. So Jesus isn't replacing an Old Testament ethic with a New Testament ethic. He's just summarizing the purpose and heart of the law that God gave to Moses. But beyond that, another reason that we should be careful about thinking that all we need are those two commandments Jesus quotes is because taken by themselves, apart from their context within books like Leviticus and Deuteronomy, they're a little ambiguous. After all, what does it really mean to love God with your heart and soul and mind? Does that just mean that you're supposed to have feelings of affection for God? Or that you're supposed to value God more than anything else in your life? Well, no. As we've already seen in this study, that command requires us to obey God, to serve Him, to have no other gods, to avoid idolatry at all costs, to have regular communal celebrations where we remember what He's done for us and give Him thanks. In the same way, the command to love your neighbor as yourself, it's not as simple or straightforward as just being a generally nice person or having feelings of goodwill or just trying not to harm each other. Deuteronomy says that we owe each other a lot more than that. Deuteronomy 15, for instance, says that loving your neighbor means doing what you can to rescue them when they fall into indebtedness or poverty. Deuteronomy 17 and 19 says that loving your neighbor includes loving your neighbor's reputation and even putting in legal safeguards to prevent them from being falsely accused in court. Deuteronomy 20 suggests that loving your neighbor means conducting yourself ethically and justly in a time of war. And in Deuteronomy chapter 22, we learn that to love your neighbor well, you must love your neighbor's life and property and marriage. First, you got to love your neighbor's life. In our last session, I talked about the laws surrounding intentional murder and accidental manslaughter and how the response to those actions demonstrate Deuteronomy's deep commitment to the inherent sanctity of human life. But it's important to note that Deuteronomy doesn't think that the only time a person does something wrong is if he or she knowingly and intentionally murders his neighbor. It's not the only way that you can be guilty of shedding innocent blood. Simple negligence can also make you guilty before God. There's a precedent already for this in Exodus chapter 21. In a series of laws about bodily harm, Moses addresses the situation of harm or even mortal injury that comes about as a result of negligence. When an ox gores a man or woman to death, he says, that ox shall be put to death, but the owner won't be held liable for the animal's actions. If, however, if the ox has been accustomed to gore in the past, and its owner has been warned but has not kept it in, and it kills a man or woman, the ox shall be stoned and its owner shall be put to death. In Deuteronomy 22, we find a very similar rule. But instead of focusing on violent animal behavior, This one is focused on building regulations. When you build a new house, you shall make a parapet for your roof, that you may not bring the guilt of blood upon your house if anyone should fall from it. This law seems reasonable enough today. After all, anyone who works in construction knows you've got to abide by numerous building codes and safety regulations, and that failing to do so renders you liable for any injury that occurs. And that makes sense. After all, flat roofs in ancient Israel, they were places where people relaxed, and if you didn't take necessary precaution, someone could fall from your roof and be seriously hurt or even killed. Seems sensible enough. But notice the theological point that's being made through this law. What God is telling the Israelites isn't simply that they'll be legally accountable for failing to follow proper safety regulations. What he's saying is you have a duty to care about your neighbor's safety and well-being. And that doesn't just mean that you can't go out and murder someone. It means you have to be diligent, and you have an obligation to protect their lives, even when it means paying for extra building materials and extra labor costs. This is just one more reminder, as one commentator puts it. It's one more reminder that you have a duty not merely not to kill, but actively to care for the lives of others at one's own cost. And that's not all. Because not only does loving your neighbor mean you have to take responsibility for your neighbor's life, it also means you have to love your neighbor's property. Deuteronomy 22 begins with a commandment about what to do if you see your neighbor's ox or sheep wandering around. You shall not see your brother's ox or his sheep going astray and ignore them. You shall take them to your brother. Notice the wording of that command. It's not just an exhortation to go out of your way and be particularly neighborly. It doesn't say, if you have time, you should probably return your neighbor's lost animal, or you know, a really good neighbor would go out of her way to make sure her neighbor's animal's returned. In fact, it doesn't even say you should return the ox or sheep. If you notice, the command is actually stated as a prohibition. You are absolutely forbidden from ignoring your neighbor's lost animal. You are prohibited from looking the other way. And then two verses later, it extends this principle from lost animals to lost property of any kind. And you shall do the same with his donkey or with his garment or with any lost thing of your brother's, which he loses and you find. You may not ignore it. That last line, you may not ignore it, I think that's the key line, because it means that loving your neighbor isn't optional, nor is it something that only particularly good people do. This is a basic requirement for every Israelite. This is what you owe to each other. It also helps put in perspective the great injustice that is exhibited in the story Jesus tells about the Good Samaritan. You remember what happens before the Samaritan shows up and he helps that Jewish man who's been beaten and robbed and is lying on the side of the road? First comes a priest who sees the man, but decides he has something more important or something better to do, and he just passes on by. And then comes a Levite, maybe on his way to the temple. And he too sees the man lying there in a ditch, and he too just walks right on by. And then finally comes a Samaritan who picks the man up and takes him to an inn and pays the innkeeper to look after him. And you know, it's funny, we often tell the story as if the Samaritan is some kind of moral hero for doing what he did. And of course, it's true that Jews and Samaritans, they didn't get along. And it's ironic that a Samaritan of all people was the one to help the man. But that Samaritan wasn't being heroic. He was just fulfilling the basic duties of loving his neighbor. All he was doing, as Jesus said, all he was doing was proving to be a neighbor to a man in need. What's really shocking about that story, what is absolutely scandalous, is the outrageous conduct of the priest and Levite, because they too had a duty. They were expected to take measures to protect their neighbor's life, and if they had a responsibility not to ignore a lost ox or sheep, how much more so did they have an obligation not to look the other way when he himself was laying there in a ditch? You may not ignore it. That's what Moses says. And that's exactly what those two men did that day. Finally, along with these random laws about life and property in the first part of the chapter, most of Deuteronomy 22 is devoted to laws about what we owe one another when it comes to marriage. Some of the laws are meant to protect women. For instance, verses 13 through 19 detail the consequences of what should happen to a man who takes a wife and then decides he doesn't want her for some reason, and so he makes up some false story about her not being a virgin and tries to get rid of her. If someone does that, and it's discovered that his accusations are false, then God says, "Then the elders of that city shall take the man and whip him, and they shall fine him 100 shekels of silver and give them to the father of the young woman, because he has brought a bad name upon a virgin of Israel, and she shall be his wife. He may not divorce her all his days." You may think that this is a pretty unfortunate outcome for the bride as well. I mean, who really wants to be stuck in a marriage with someone that went around accusing them of sexual immorality? But keep in mind that in an ancient, patriarchal, agrarian culture like this, women were incredibly vulnerable and very dependent on either their fathers or their husbands. And Deuteronomy knows how gossip tends to spread, and he knows that this man's lies are going to make it very difficult for this woman to find another husband. So this law is meant to protect her. But in addition to the laws about sexual infidelity before marriage, there are also laws about sexual infidelity within marriage. Verse 22 says, "If a man is caught lying with the wife of another man, both the man and woman are to be put to death. Likewise, if a man sleeps with a woman who's betrothed," which is practically the same thing as being married, "then the same punishment applies." But the following verses note that there are exceptions to this. If in the open country a man meets a young woman who's betrothed, and the man seizes her and lies with her, then only the man who lay with her shall die. But you shall do nothing to the young woman. She has committed no offense punishable by death. There's a difference, in other words, between consensual adultery and rape. And in the case of the latter, the woman has done nothing wrong. In all these laws, there are two principles that seem to be consistently upheld. First, men have a responsibility to guard and protect both the bodies and the reputations of women who inhabit a more vulnerable position within society. And second, every Israelite has a duty to love their neighbor by loving and honoring and protecting their neighbor's marriage. Now, today, of course, many people would regard a sexual ethic like this as nothing but a quaint thing of the past. Or maybe worse, as a repressive set of restrictions, just holding consenting adults back from doing what they want. In the 1960s, many Western countries that had long upheld a basic Christian morality when it comes to sex and marriage enthusiastically abandoned those morals for a new way of life. A new way of life predicated on the rights of adults to do as they please and hopeful for the freedom and the pleasure that would surely follow. At least that was the promise. But that's not really how things turned out, as a lot of people are now coming to realize. Turns out a society in which marriage is not honored and adults are free to just pursue pleasure as they see fit isn't all it's cracked up to be. One author who's written about this at length is Louise Perry, who published a best-selling book a couple years ago entitled The Case Against the Sexual Revolution. Ironically, Louise Perry isn't a Christian, nor is she Jewish. Nor does she think that a book like Deuteronomy carries any divine authority. And yet, she makes a very persuasive case that all of the supposed freedoms that came from the sexual revolution, that they haven't been a good thing, especially for women. In fact, they've been remarkably harmful. And the most humane thing we can do, she argues in her book, the most humane thing we can do is to get back to a society that honors marriage and holds men accountable for their sexual behavior. In other words, despite her lack of religious faith, what she thinks would be best is if we could love our neighbors by loving our neighbors' marriages. So why read Deuteronomy then? Why read all these ancient laws addressed to people who lived thousands of years ago in the context of some ancient Mesopotamian culture? Why can't we just simplify things and just love our neighbors? Because what we learn from Deuteronomy is that just like loving God, loving your neighbor isn't as straightforward as you might think. And left to our own devices, we might do what that priest and Levite did and just smile and look the other way. So we need Deuteronomy to remind us that loving your neighbor means loving your neighbor's reputation and life and property and marriage and taking responsibility for them, even when it costs you something.